Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome, everybody, to this week's Behind the Curtain. I'm Paul Lisnick, and lots of fun stuff to talk about with you today. We're going to start with the look at a brand new book called Pitchfork Populism. Pitchfork Populism, 10 political forces that shaped an election and continue to change America. The author is Bradford Kane, with lots of experience in the federal government and state government. He has worked in California and Washington, even once worked in the legislative side for Illinois Congresswoman Curtis Collins. But we want to talk about the new book, getting great reviews. Brad, welcome to Behind the Curtain. I appreciate your time.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much.
So I do want to walk through the various factors that you you set out in the book, but I suppose if I were to, as I read through it, it's almost as though you asked the question, why did people vote for Donald Trump? And you try and explain the passion and where it came from, because some people liked him, some people didn't, but they still voted for him. What's the summary answer to that one?
Basically, it comes down to you know, with these different forces that were emerging. So yes, there was a lot of passion from a lot of different different groups of Americans. So it's not a question of looking at the country as a whole. It's a question of breaking it down into constituencies, geographies, and for example, in chapter one, I talk about national identity split personality we have between individualists and collectivists. So that's an example where one side of that seemed to be more open, more receptive to someone like Donald Trump. But getting into some of the more contemporary issues that we dealt with in the years leading to 2016, there were a lot of Americans that still hadn't been excavated from the rubble of the economic crisis in 2008 and 2009, and a lot of them felt left behind. Donald Trump had a very different kind of message. He tapped into that. Basically, he was against both parties, really, in many ways, his message was. And so a lot of people were looking for something new. They wanted to try a different route. So
but
they
it's also
they'd give it a try, knowing that the alternative was someone who was much more, you know, established in one particular party philosophy and legacy.
I'm going to stop you there. It's also interesting that while you do talk about national identity in chapter one, this individualism, collectivism point, you also talk about the fact that we're all united by our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. So there are these unifying documents that should bring people together, but don't seem to. And I'm wondering if that answer comes through a little bit in your second point, which has to do with the demographics. You say as a society, we're sort of all heading towards numerical parity. Please explain that. But you basically said, look, this has always been a factor, whether it was LBJ, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Obama, it's always been a factor.
That's right. Basically, different groups of Americans get activated at different times. And once people become enfranchised in the process, people don't leave the process. Other groups also want to come and join the effort. And so in my chapter where I talk about the democratization of the political process, especially since the 1960s, one can go further back in history, but especially since the 60s, there was a group of activists that very much became part of the American political dialogue, which basically opened the door for others to want to get involved. And then you had a lot of different movements. You had the environmental movement, you had the evangelical movement, and it went back and forth often in different sides of the aisle too, as to, you know, which party was in power, and that spurred on certain other groups of people to get involved. You also brought up the point about numerical parity. What I'm referring to about that in chapter two about demographics is that the Census Bureau anticipates that in the year 2042 we will become a majority-minority country. That will have implications, and some people find that a cause for celebration. Some people are concerned. There's going to be some growing pains, I believe. But ultimately, I believe that is the strength of the United States, because what you said before is the bottom line. What we are united by is not, we are not defined as a country by race, religion, or anything else that were those classical characteristics from other continents and other eras. We are defined by our values as a nation, by our Constitution and the 27 amendments to the Constitution, and certain fundamental principles. And the more that we can look at issues in terms of our underlying values, the more that we have in common.
And, of course, the way those things get defined are through the issues that become the focus of elections and of our daily dialogue. You write that content is king. I think that's true. People have different views on the policies, the principles that they want to see guide our country. But it's sort of interesting, as this book truly does focus in on Donald Trump. And one of the points you make is, look, he campaigned as a populist, but he's really anything but.
That's absolutely right. So, first of all, you know, the comment about what unites us as a people, that is, you know, where I think we eventually, you know, it's like the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice from Dr. King. Over time, we move in the right direction, but Donald Trump has taken us toward division instead. So, I got off track from your last comment.
Well, I will go back to Trump as a populist, because he would talk about the fact that, you know, that he is, but he doesn't, his policies don't go that way. But it's really interesting. I'll go back and kind of expand my question a little bit, because, sure. For example, you know, his actions to the LGBTQ community, which seems to, you know, limit some rights in terms of not permitting transgender to serve in the military and whatever. And yet you get the log cabin Republicans to endorse him before the election's even underway. He's got this appeal and this charisma and this reach to people, even though it seems that the actions of administration don't necessarily match the words that he says.
You're hitting the crux of what makes Donald Trump viable, or what made him viable in 2016, in that basically we in the United States have a long history of populism. We don't need to get into that right here, right now, but the fundamental thing about populism in the United States historically is that it has been a set of movements that empowers the masses, as in the word populism itself. In Donald Trump's case, it's different. He motivates his base, the people who, and he does pluck their emotional cords, he motivates his base to empower him. That is not populism. That, if anything, allows him to therefore act according to his own self-interest, according to his whim and his caprice. That leads to his transactional approach toward decision-making, and that ultimately hews in the direction of authoritarianism if it gets out of control. That's what we saw in the Mueller report. The Mueller report talked about the 10, 11, or 12 instances of obstruction of justice, and that's what we're seeing right now today with regard to Ukraine and the different things that are coming out in the hearings in terms of Donald Trump basically feeling like he can do as he wishes, because it's not about the best interests of the masses, which would be populism. It's about the self-interest of Donald Trump.
When you think about the abuses of the Constitution that Richard Nixon pursued, the fact that the media at that time was essentially major newspapers and the three main networks, you know, that was what Nixon battled. And there was really nobody in his court. In fact, I think CNN is doing a special on him, or a documentary, where they're in his own words, where he basically says, you've got to paint the media negative. You've got to go after the media. So these days, the power of the media in this search of battle in truth, talk for a bit about, you know, there's so much media today that the truth is you can watch various hearings on television, or you can skip the hearings and then go seek out the interpretation of those hearings that meet your worldviews. You're conservative, turn on Fox. You're liberal, watch MSNBC. And it all gets tainted in the mix. We didn't have that in the early 70s.
You are so right, Paul. This is what I refer to in my chapter about the media and truth and fact. I refer to it as the good, the bad, and the ugly. And basically the good is that media today doesn't have the gatekeeper that it had for centuries. Anyone can jump into the media and put forth views, and anyone can create a platform. That part's good. Empowerment and equal opportunity for everyone to be heard. The bad is that we don't have any common baseline set of facts and understandings, the way in the days a lot of us remember Walter Cronkite, for example. When he spoke, there were certain facts that were commonly shared among Americans. The ugly is that because of the fragmentation of, like what you were just talking about, different people getting different news from different sources, and it's not curated and there's no verification and validation, because of that fragmentation, it opens the door for manipulation. And Donald Trump, we all can agree, I think everyone would agree, that his real tremendous skill set, is branding. He's a salesman. He sells things. And marketing. So basically, when he says something, and he doesn't say it once, he says it two times, three times, four times, he's trying to implant a meme, a thought among in the minds of those who are receptive to it. Basically, that manipulates the flow of fact and thinking among those who are willing to accept it, not among others who will reserve critical thinking for themselves, but among those who are looking for someone like that strong individualist who tells them what to do, they are willing to receive his message. And that's the problem with the media fragmentation.
And that probably takes us into your discussion in the book about accountability and transparency, because as you say, I think on this, your words, I think were that Trump essentially sets a stratospheric standard on all of this. And part of it is because we're left with some ambiguity. He talks about draining the swamp. Democrats would say, no, he's stocking the swamp. But the truth is, we don't ever really know what he meant anyway. We just think we know what he meant. He's never told us.
That's right. His campaign was all a bunch of slogans. There are some campaigns that have detailed policy papers. He did not. He didn't even have an interest in doing that. It was all slogan-based. Even when he became president, of course, we're going to have great health care. What does that mean? Huh? So when it came to drain the swamp, getting into the accountability point that you raised, what does that mean? It's kind of a green screen. Everyone can read into it whatever they want. What it turns out, as we're seeing in practice, is that Donald Trump knows these things because he's been the purveyor of these things. He's been around people who have done these things. When you look at things that Pruitt did, that Zinke did, EPA Administrator Pruitt, who's no longer there,
right.
Former Secretary of Interior Zinke, former Secretary of HHS Tom Price, different things, different extravagances where they would just use government money and expenses to their own benefit. There have been reports about Secretary Wilbur Ross remaining on boards of certain companies under which he has some kind of authority, and he still has meetings with them. There are conflicts of interest all over the place. Donald Trump knows these things. He even told us this on the campaign in 2016 when he was saying, I've given money to all these people. I know these kind of practices better than anyone. Well, maybe he does, because he was actually part of that. The interesting thing is, we didn't even have to do major digging for that. He told us that. This is what he told us.
Yeah.
So drain the swamp. It sounds like he had some plans as to how he was going to use the federal government to his personal benefit.
And although you didn't really write about this point, to me it's related to that, which is, you know, what somebody says and then what they do are often two different things, especially when the sayer is charismatic, as I think Trump supporters would absolutely find him to be. What I have in mind is, for example, on the health care issue, where the president in his rallies and everywhere else will say, we're going to give you the greatest health care you've ever seen, and
right,
Republicans will protect your pre-existing conditions. Democrats won't, Republicans will. But probably because I'm a lawyer, I know that the position of the administration before the courts literally now is to say protecting pre-existing conditions should be found to be unconstitutional. The administration is working to remove the protection of pre-existing conditions. But the president says, we're going to protect them. Democrats aren't. How do you wake people up to the fact that what he's saying on that instance and what is actually happening in the courts are not the same thing?
Well, let me talk both in terms of what you raised about healthcare and then the broader picture. With healthcare, it's fascinating. From the beginning, when he began talking about that, when that started happening in 2017, it was clear that he wanted a win. He definitely wanted a win. And he didn't really care what it looked like. And I say that because if you look back at his statements, he contradicted himself over and over and over. At one point, he said something that made it sound like everyone was going to get health, going to be assured of having health care. But then he said, corrected it and said, you know, everyone will have access to health insurance, which means you can buy it if you can afford it. So he contradicts himself at early stages. But even after the House passed, the Republican-controlled House passed a version of, you know, what he called, you know, something to, from his point of view, that what he wanted to see happen, he called it a mean bill. It was his bill. He called it a mean bill. He was contradicting himself all along the way. He just wanted basically a win. You know, fast forward, it's kind of, I hate to say it, but it's kind of Orwellian. You know, like, why is it that when he's contradicting himself and he's, the Washington Post fact checker, of course, has kept a running tally of his, let's say, falsehoods. And as of about a month ago, they were up to 13,500. So now it's obviously beyond that. And at a certain point, you realize that that is his stock in trade. So one of the things that I count on Americans to live up to is common sense, not divorcing everything they've always known about Americans and about humanity and about appropriate conduct and about common sense. And at a certain point, refocus on those principles and those values that they were taught and brought up with and that they have made part of their lives and they would teach their children, but they made an exception for Donald Trump. So when you talk about whether it's, you know, I don't want to single out one particular group of Republicans because different people may have had different interests, but at this point they can see very clearly, forget about 2016, they can see very clearly now who he is. And hopefully they will take the personal responsibility to act accordingly.
The book extends into the global economy, into federalism, into bipartisan work. I do want to ask you, I'll go back to the title of the book before I let you go, Brad, which is, it's called Pitchfork Populism. I probably should have kicked this off, but tell me what that title means. Now that we've been talking about what you address, what is pitchfork populism?
Absolutely. Pitchfork populism is the notion of, first of all, if you want a visual, I like to think in terms of the old Frankenstein movie where the townsfolk are all upset and worried, so they storm the castle with pitchforks and lanterns and torches. It's a type of populism as opposed to many populist movements in the United States that were agrarian or economic, wanting to have, you know, a decent standard of living or not live in tenement housing and wanting to not have to work 7 days a week, 20 hours a day. This kind of those are economic populism. Those were, you know, human rights types of populism. This type of populism is based on anger, fear, and resentment that Donald Trump has stoked. We know that fear and hope are two opposite motivators of people, whether it be at election time or even more broadly. Donald Trump has clearly placed himself on the side of the purveyor of fear, resentment, and basically also animosity toward people who he can scapegoat, and that's why he's been antagonistic toward certain groups of people. And the people, and that's what I refer to as pitchfork populism. It's a sanitized version of mob rule when people are upset, and instead of giving them practical solutions, it's more like to let them vent their anger.
The book is called Pitchfork Populism, 10 Political Forces That Shaped an Election and Continue to Change America. Brad Kane, thanks for your insight. It's a really interesting book, and it's available on Amazon and probably wherever better books are sold. Thank you, sir. We'll look forward to seeing you on Politics Tonight soon as well.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks, Brad.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it that you...
Well, you can't think of a better song to open up this next segment with than Sinatra singing Chicago, because, you know, throughout the entire last century, 20th century, there are so many places to love in this city. Jazz clubs and blues clubs and comedy and the hotels and the nightclubs and the restaurants and the movie theaters and the legitimate theaters and the sports arenas, and you go on and on. What a great city this is. And it has been captured in a new book called Entertaining Chicago, Remembering the Places, Performers, and Stories Throughout the 20th Century. It's authored by Neil Sammers, who rightfully is a Chicago native. Otherwise, you don't get to write a book like this.
That's right.
He's written lots of books. I think it's 26 at last count about Chicago, the neighborhoods, the people, and all of that. And Bob Dauber grew up here, then became a trader for a while and went to Texas, but he's back where he knew life was better. And he hosts a weekly radio show called Jazz Lives, along with work in film and other areas. So, guys, you're the perfect team to write this book. And I know it's not your first time working together, but welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So the book is not a narrative. You know, when I first saw it, I thought, I'm going to read this narrative of these places. It's not. It's all told through the eyes and words of a variety of people, and they span the spectrum. So, Neil, I'll start with you. How did this project start, and how did you decide that the best way to talk about these classic Chicago places are through the people who work there, live there, perform there?
Well, Paul, it's very, very simple. About a year ago, I had a call from David Marienthal, whose father and uncle owned and operated Mr. Kelly's London House and Happy Medium. And David wanted to do is working on a documentary about those places and wanted me to develop a book with him about them. But when I looked into it and talked to people, there were a lot of people, depending on their age, who never heard of them, amazingly. But Bob and I started talking and realized it would be much better to expand this, and so we're looking at the places, performers, and stories throughout the 20th century, and that's where the book goes to.
Just amazing. So I have to tell you, my mind went right to, there was one place, I just thought, how did these guys remember this? It was the Mill Run Theater. It was behind the Golf Mill Theater. And Golf Mill was run by my cousin. He's gone now, but Benny Stein was his name. And he used to run the Golf Mill Theater, very big in the variety clubs. I say the name because you guys might have heard of him.
Oh, we might.
And so in the Mill Run Theater, man, where Jerry Lewis would perform, they had the biggest names, where I once tried to imitate him from the audience, and he said, the world isn't ready for two of us. I mean, you have these great clubs in the cities, but even in the surrounding areas like Mill Run, that was sort of, I think the effort of Mill Run was to bring Vegas to Chicago, right, Bob?
It, certainly the people who perform there, you know, would qualify for that description. I remember going there a number of times, and most memorable ones that I remember seeing, Woody Allen, George Carlin, Chaka Khan, Jim Croce, and I lived in Glenview at the time, so driving over to Mill Run was about a 10-minute drive.
Yeah, it was kind of an easy place to go to. You can even park. Neil, let me go back to it and just start with, kind of take it by sections, but you know, you take a look at all sorts of clubs, jazz clubs, and you go to different parts of the city, downtown, Old Town, and South. But I'm sure since this book came out, you have friends and family members who said, you forgot this one, you didn't include this one, what about this one? Not to mention that I thought I should have been quoted throughout the book in almost all of these places that you write about. But
Well, you were, but you didn't know it.
I apparently not. So am I right, Neil? Have you heard from people saying, and my question is, did you miss out on some stuff, or did you say, no, we only could do a certain number, and this is what we picked?
No, but I told Bob, I haven't myself yet, but I expect people to tell me that I forgot about such and such. But the idea was this was not going to become an encyclopedia of every single entertainment venue in Chicago. So we picked the places based on the stories and the interviews, and we try to cover a wide range, and that's why I even included a whole section here about sports in Chicago.
Actually, Neil, Bob, I'll go to you, Bob. What came first? Based on that answer, did the place come first and you need to go find people? Or you were interviewing people and you went, oh, yeah, we better be talking about, you know, the Auditorium Theater?
Well, I would say almost exclusively, Paul, the people came first, because in interviewing folks, and as I described this process, I would interview somebody, and it was like peeling an artichoke. You would be talking to somebody, and then, you know, you peel a petal off of an artichoke, yeah, and there's something next. So in talking with people, it would be, you know, they'd say, oh, you know, you need to talk to, you should talk to this one, you should talk to this one. But invariably, in interviewing people, and yes, we had targeted people that we wanted to interview, but then a lot of them were introduced to us because of the interview I was doing. So almost invariably, in the people that I spoke with, the places came up based upon their input.
And Neil, you have an introduction in the book by Gary Johnson, the president of Chicago History Museum, and one of the things that caught my attention, because I read that before I read the book, and he talked about the fact that you were interviewing people, some of whom are still around, some of whom are gone. In fact, it caught my attention, because some of the names of people that are still around, I thought were gone, and I'm wrong. I'm glad to hear that some of them are still around, but how long, Neil, were you working on this book? Because you did interview people who have been gone for a bit.
Well, Paul, this is 20 years of interviews, to tell you the truth. It started off in earlier books, and the more I went back, the more I saw that they were talking about places of entertainment, and so I started using that as a basis for it. And I would just tell you one other thing. The interview about the story about the Blue Note happened because I read in the paper about a
student I had had when I was teaching at Barrow College, and I called her up to say hello, and she said, you ought to talk to Tom Holzfind, whose father, Frank, owned the Blue Note. And that's where I got with that. But so it's a combination for Bob and I of newer interviews and interviews with people we had talked to before.
And, Bob, there were some pictures, like you have Barbara Streisand outside of Mr. Kelly's, which she's so famous for. Actually, it's a photo I'm familiar with because I think she's actually posted it herself, and some other places she's played, which made me think, did you try and get to some folks like Barbara Streisand to say, hey, we're writing this book, I need to talk to you? And it just wasn't happening. Were there some people that surprised you that were available to you? I know you guys talked to Shecky Green. I love Shecky Green growing up as a comedian. Were there folks who, you know, didn't want to help or you just couldn't reach?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the bigger interviews in the book is a man by the name of Randy Waldman. And there's a picture of Randy with Streisand. Randy has been her personal pianist for over 35 years. And Randy was introduced to me by a former film sound guy that I had worked with in Dallas many years ago. And I told him about the project and the book that we were doing. And he said, oh, you need to talk to Randy Waldman. He's an ex-Chicagoan, multi-Grammy winner, and so forth and so on. So introductions were made. I had several conversations with Randy prior to actually doing the interview. And I did say, what would the possibility be? Well, of talking to her. If you saw my picture, I have a better chance of growing hair than talking with her. But that's okay. People that came to mind, like for another one, and there's Judy Roberts. Well, I've known Judy Roberts for a number of years. Bones Malone is another story in there, who used to play in Letterman's band. I've known Bones for years. So just reaching out to those people, that's how these places came about that are in the book.
And Neil, by the way, you talked to, you know, you've got the section of hotels like the Drake Hotel, of course, is such a classic, the Knickerbocker. And you talked to folks like Neil Hartigan, who was Illinois Attorney General. I mean, some of these names were sort of as I came out, and I knew Hartigan, but some of these names are, why the tie? How did you make certain ties between some places like Neil Hartigan and the Drake Hotel as opposed to some other place? Or once again, were they mentioning these places when you talked with them?
Neil Hartigan had been a part of my earlier books on the history of Rogers Park because that's where he lived and grew up. And so Hartigan wanted to talk about his uncle, Tweets Hogan, who played orchestra and played a band in the various hotels. So that's how I got Hartigan. But I would like to tell you that Tom Dreesen, who was a person I had talked to over the years, and he was very helpful in getting to a variety of people. But Dreesen, as you started off with Sinatra, Dreesen used to travel with Sinatra.
Yeah.
And Dreesen also put me in touch with his former partner, Tim Reed, the first black and white and only black and white comedy team in American history.
So one led to another, which was great. How did you create the categories? I mean, you even have a section talking about different ballrooms, the Savoy, the Aragon. I mean, I was trying to, if I was writing a book like this, I guess I would start by thinking, what categories do I want to have? Are there some categories, Neil, that we don't have here that after, once again, you finished the book, you went, oh, we could have looked at this too?
No, I felt we covered most categories.
Yeah, that's why I kept it generic. I didn't have one. I was just curious whether you did.
The concept was, as Bob said, whoever we talked to would suggest other things, and we would then look at just like comedy or rock and roll clubs or things like that that we hadn't thought of at first. We added in because of people's ideas.
And Bob,
I want to add to that too. When you were talking earlier, when we first started about, have people brought up, oh, you missed this one or you missed that one. I had the pleasure of working with Neil 8 years ago on the Chicago's Classic Restaurants book. And we did do presentations where we'd have book signings and we had a PowerPoint presentation. And people would say, well, you missed this thing or you missed that thing. And he said, well, if you tried to cover everything, you'd have a book the size of Cleveland. So, you know, that will probably come up, but I think not as frequently with this book as it did with the restaurant book, because everybody had their favorite places to eat that they thought were classic.
And maybe now your sequel could be about Cleveland.
I don't know.
No, volume 2.
All right.
Yeah, Volume 2 is right.
Well, the section I love, because I also cover theater and do so much in there. So when I got to the movie theaters and the legitimate theater section, I loved it. And what I think a lot of people don't remember, Neil, is, you know, you've got pictures of the State Lake and all these grand theaters. And I can remember as a kid, but when I was a kid, many of these theaters were already in disrepair. So you might go to the State Lake to see, here's what I do remember, all five Planet of the Apes movies running in one day, and with a rat that would run across the stage while you were watching the movies.
Yes,
so things kind of went downhill, but the photos you put in there remind me of the incredible grandeur that these theaters were back in the day.
Well, we could have an entire book, and there have been books done about the whole history of the Balaban and Katz palaces.
Yeah.
Downtown and around Chicago. It wasn't just downtown. And yes, I did a book years ago called Downtown Chicago in Transition, and we try to cover all these theaters because people remember, just like I do growing up in Chicago, the grandeur of the Balaban and Katz theaters, and Bob and I have talked about it, where they'd, by the way, they'd have live stage shows.
That's right.
So
for example, Martin and Lewis, Desi and Lucy would perform as part of the way they would promote whatever their movie was.
And I saw Gene Autry and Trigger at the Chicago Theater.
You know, I do remember reading that. I'm glad you said that because I forgot about that. They had the horse on stage?
Absolutely.
Wow, did you get to pet him?
The Chicago Theater, by the way, too. The last show that was done there, Edie Gourmet was the final performer of the stage show there, and she appeared with Milt Trenier on that, and that was I want to say that was probably back around 1960 perhaps.
Ah.
And prior to that
with Steve Lawrence?
No, Steve wasn't there, but glad that you mentioned him, because prior to that, and it was maybe a year or two before that, Edie Gourmet was the closing act at the Chez Paris, and at that particular performance, and I was there for that one too, Steve was in the Army, and he came walking on stage in uniform as a surprise. Whether it was or not, I don't know, but that's what the shtick was that she wasn't expecting him, and here he walked on the stage at the Chez Paris, but she was the closing act at both of those establishments.
Ah, I love it. That's great. And I also, when I was reading about Steppenwolf, and of course, it made sense. You interviewed many members of the ensemble, Gary Sinise and Bill Peterson, Joe Mantegna. Joe Mantegna,
right,
by the way, was on this podcast just a week ago in his role as director of the I'm Not a Comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. So that's a plug
great
for
show.
Last week.
Huh? Great show.
Yeah, it was a fantastic show. Ronnie Marmo joined me as well. So if you haven't listened to that interview, check it out. And Mike Nussbaum, of course, who was about 300 years old, but he's still going strong and is just one of the most amazing actors in the city. So so many of the legitimate theaters, the Steppenwolf, Goodman, and you do in the history sort of say, look, here's where they started, because some people think, you know, Steppenwolf started where it is, or the Goodman's in the beautiful building that it was. Well, they weren't. I remember Goodman in the Art Institute location, Steppenwolf.
Right.
Yeah, these places. So how did you, when you wrestled with it, and I think as you sort of said, almost every one of these entities, you could have walked through a history of it just to show, especially in the legitimate theater section, just to show its development.
Well, I just tell you, this whole thing with Dreesen is very interesting, because Dreesen was the one who connected me when I did the original interviews with Peterson and Sinise and Mantegna. He put me in touch with them and asked them to talk to me, and so therefore I got the full history through him from them.
And there we get the pieces.
Right.
Neil, did you say before, I forgot who was answering this sort of early on, where you said we kind of had this and then realized we would sort of add in the sports venues. So we do get...
Neil
said
that.
Neil,
well,
okay.
I felt that this book, and that Entertainment Chicago should include sports. And since I had interviewed all these people over the years for earlier books, I wanted to include that in here and then get in more contemporary, some of the stories about the championship teams later on in the 20th century. So we have quite a range of interviews and stories and people from the 20th century across all the sports teams.
And so, Bob,
sports thing, too, also, you'll find in an interview in the book Ira Burko, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He wrote for the New York Times for years, went to the same high school that Neil and I went to. And Ira, in my interviewing him, told the story about Eddie Waitkus getting shot at the Edgewater Beach Hotel.
Ah.
And that's a sports-related story, folks.
And I have to say that the person who financially sponsored us doing this book, Lee Stern, trader at the Board of Trade and the original owner of the Chicago Sting and a part owner of the White Sox now, Lee gave us the money to do the book.
Which you do thank him in the book, because I saw that as well. Absolutely. So, Bob, when people read, I mean, look, I ate this stuff up because I'm a lover of history. I'm a lover of Chicago. This was sort of everything somebody like me would want in a book. So I truly enjoyed reading it cover to cover. But when you wrote it, or the purpose, what is it you want the average reader to get? I mean, is this a book for people who, like me, grew up here and love it? Or is this, you know, somebody from Cleveland who maybe has never been to Chicago? Do you want to share it with them, too?
Sorry I mentioned Cleveland, Paul.
No, I'm going to stick with it.
You keep bringing it up. No. Certainly, you know, for people to remember it. And let me tell you what, I'll give you an example, and I've talked about this with Neil. This is something that's happened really just in the past week or two. We don't get the opportunity to watch people's reactions to the book very much so far. And a week ago yesterday, I had breakfast with a friend of mine who has purchased a copy of the book, and I brought it, you know, to breakfast. And watching her thumb through the book and watching her face, that was a treat, because, you know, I'm just sitting there watching, and the look of amazement and the look of joy and the look of remembrance and all of these things, you know, that are rolled into a great ball of entertainment. Because, and in fact, when I've autographed books, I just say, enjoy exploring the past, because that's what it is.
And Paul, I tell you that the key word in this entire title of the book is the word remembering, because people apply their own memories to all these stories.
Well, you found me doing that just as I talked to you. I mean, I think I opened this up with just, you know, having read what was a simple page in the book about Mill Run, and boom, there I was, you know, reliving childhood. And there were more stories I could have told you, but I spared you. But that's what I loved about it, was just, you know, if you grew up here, if you are of a certain age, you know, you just look back and say, this is my city, and you just have such pride in it. So I really thank you for not just this book, all the books that you guys do that just really show that you love this city. And I appreciate it. The book Entertainment Chicago, Remembering the Places, Performers, and Stories Throughout the 20th Century. I probably should have emphasized the word remembering, since you did that. But it's a book available on Amazon, and probably where you can get better books everywhere. And I wish you guys a lot of luck with it. I'm glad you came up with this, and I'm glad I found it. So congratulations. It's really wonderful.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Right. We had a piano in the kitchen. It wasn't a very big kitchen, but it was the warmest room in the house, and we used to gather around it and sing soul songs. There's this one song, Drown in My Own Tears by Ray Charles, that she used to sing a lot. And there's this one particular moment about halfway through that it just sends shivers down my spine. The way that he sings the word, you, it's like it's coming out of someone else's mouth. We all used to just gather and just howl it like wolves.
And yes, some piano music follows that, but I cut it off before you got to hear that. You'll have to see the show to hear the music that follows. That is a clip from an incredibly brilliant is the best word I can say, but unique show called Every Brilliant Thing. It's currently playing at Windy City Playhouse South, not the one on Irving Park, the one down on Michigan Avenue, through December 15th. And it's a one-woman show starring Rebecca Spence. And I got to tell you, Rebecca, number one, welcome to the podcast. But number two, the reviews of this show, including the Tribune's Chris Jones, who can be tough on a show, he could not praise this thing enough in terms of how good it makes people feel.
Well, I'm really grateful for that. I mean, I'm grateful that a show that is promoting joy as a radical act sells well.
Yeah, good point.
It's wonderful. It's nice to have people respond to it. It's nice that people have, you know, emotional reactions to it. And I think it resonates with everyone. I think that everyone either is going through a journey like it themselves, or is loving someone that is. And so I think it resonates with everyone on a certain aspect. So the fact that people are responding to it is lovely. And it's more than I could hope for. So I'm really happy about that.
Windy City Playhouse is probably the perfect venue to have this produced because, and as I've talked to A.B. Rubenstein, the artistic director of there, they started this thing a few years ago with Southern Gothic, this notion of immersive theater. And I remember saying to Amy, one of the first times I interviewed her, saying, you found a niche, you have a niche in this city. And that is this immersive theater approach. And it is what they've been doing pretty much ever since with all their shows, Boys in the Band, coming up in January. But it also happens with every brilliant thing. Now, I don't want to say something and have you go, oh, I wish you hadn't said that. So I'm going to ask you the general question so that you can say what you want to say about what this experience is. I will just start you off by saying it starts before the show starts.
It does. I greet every member that comes in. And in essence, I ask them to collaborate with me in a certain way. And I hope that using the word collaboration is a little better than just saying participation, because I think there's a sort of a knee-jerk hesitancy when they hear that. I think everyone feels a little unique in that they're like, I don't like to participate. And that is not rare. Most people don't enjoy participating. When you go to a show, you want to be entertained and be able to check out for a little bit. And the thought of having to be very present is very intimidating, and that's frightening for a lot of people. And if I'm doing my job well enough, I make it feel like a very safe space for them to know that we are creating an experience together, and that when we leave, we've all done it together, that nobody has been singled out in a certain way to make them feel self-conscious in a way that is embarrassing. That it is something for everyone to participate in and to collaborate with.
So it is true you greet people before we go into the theater, although I have to say it's probably true that many people don't realize they're meeting the star of the show, right?
That's true. They don't know. I get a lot of questions about subscriptions. and they want to know some general information that I sadly don't know the answers to, so I have to guide them to another source. It takes them a little minute to figure that out. And that's kind of the fun of it. That's nice.
It sounds like Teatro Zanzani. People are dressed up as maids and people think they're there to clean the place up.
Right.
But so we come in and you have mentioned the participative, collaborative part of this show, which is really fun. And I do have to say this, people that don't want to play do not have to play. But then I have to ask you this question. There are a few people you will call on to do certain things for you. The night I was there, the woman you picked as the teacher was so incredible. There are people who kind of really get into their roles. My question is, have you ever picked on anybody who just, you get a vibe, which is, no, I've come to the wrong place, I'm going to switch?
We've had a couple instances where we've had some really hesitant people, or I've thought, I'm not sure what's about to happen next, but fortunately I've never had to switch out partners. I've had to really give them a lot of eye contact and reassure them that it's going to be okay, that I'm with them throughout the entire process, and that I'm never going to let them fail. But so far, fortunately, I'm trying to find some wood to knock on. I've not had to bail on an audience member and say, this is just, it isn't working. We've had some people that are just beautiful, natural fits. We've had some other people that have really been unsure what to say. But even in that, it ends up being kind of magical as well, because a lot of times they sort of, as the evening is progressing, they relax into it and realize, okay, oh, I'm not the only one. And okay, no one's going to be laughing at me. This is part of the experience. So, we've certainly had some people that are more natural fits than others, but every experience has been really fascinating and seems to fit that evening, actually.
By the way, and I thought there might have been a setup in the show that I saw over the weekend. You picked a guy for the role. We're going to say about the role, but who plays the role of Sam? And he actually was the star of the recommendation, which had been in the Windy City Playhouse, and I knew him. So I went up afterwards. I went, oh, did she pick you knowing it was you? And he said, no, I've never met her. So that too was just random.
No, we've never met. It's always a completely random person.
Which is great.
Completely random person.
And now you also have the night I saw it. You have some people who kind of really get into their roles. I'm thinking of the woman that played Mrs. Pattinson, I think was the teacher's name, right?
Mrs. Patterson.
Patterson. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she was, I mean, I don't know if she was really a teacher, but she was so good. So do you also have the flip side of it where somebody is so into their role, you're going, you know, maybe they even ad lib a little bit and you're like, I'm liking this? Or is it sort of like a just do what I want you to do, keep it fair? Or does it work? You look like you played off whatever you get.
No, I love it when people get into the role. And it allows, I mean, when I encourage that, it allows them to sort of free themselves up and realize, okay, this is my show too. And I think it's great. And I fortunately am in a place where I can roll with it enough to get us back to where we need to be. And we've never had anybody get too carried away.
Okay.
Really, we have some people that are more natural performers than others. And sometimes that actually isn't always the best. It's the people that are really unsure of it and that start taking risks and say things that I know they certainly weren't expecting to say when they showed up that evening. And it's a really nice surprise when that happens.
Which also,
I enjoy it. I enjoy kind of every night being like, who knows where we're going to go tonight? We'll see.
And of course, you make instant stars of some of them because some of the folks who then get to play those roles have people talking to them out in the hallway. It just kind of starts this buzz as people are leaving the theater.
That's great.
Yeah, enjoying their way out. Now, I do want to say, look, there are some themes. Because it's a very uplifting show, but in fairness, there are some themes such as suicide, whatever, that come into the show. So I think it's fair enough to tell people that those are present. It's just, nevertheless, by the time the show is over, a very positive experience.
Yeah, I think so. We live in times where right now people are very uncertain about a lot of things. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, either people are going through depression right now, presently, in battle with it,
yeah,
or they are loving someone who is also going through that. And I think the important takeaway of this show is paying attention. And it's something that we mentioned a little bit in the show, but it's about ultimately paying attention. It's paying attention to yourself and paying attention to the people around you and noticing when people aren't doing so well and holding themselves up and having a hard time with that. And that's when it's our job to step in and do what we can, but know that we aren't completely responsible for everyone's happiness. And then it's also paying attention to ourselves and noticing, okay, I'm not doing well. I need to take care of myself. I need to find the things that are going to be able to buoy me right now because I'm having a hard time.
And without giving this away, I'll be ambiguous about it, but let's just say when everybody leaves, we're given a bit of a gift that allows us to carry the point of the show on and sort of embed it in our life. I'm curious, is that scripted or is that a Windy City Playhouse thing?
Which part? I'm sorry.
The fact that when we leave, I'm trying to be ambiguous about it, but we leave with a bit of a gift from the theater.
Oh, that was Windy City. That was their idea.
And
I think
it's
really lovely.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. And I've had a lot of really amazing responses about it. I, in fact, got a text the other day and a picture of someone who was utilizing it and had given it to their children who had also added to it.
Wow.
And, that kind of lives on. And I absolutely love it. I think I'm so happy that that's something that, is something that people can hold on to and perhaps continue that feeling that we try to create for them in the show.
And look, you're an actress, so I suppose one would argue this is one more role that shows up on your resume that you once performed as you look through your career. But I have a different sense of this. I have a feeling that this is a role that you as an actor won't soon forget, that this is almost a transformative role for you as an actor. Is that true?
Absolutely. No, it's been such a special experience, and it's deeply personal for me. And I receive as many gifts as I hope that I give every night, and that I walk away from it tired, but also really, really blessed and gifted with a unique experience every night. And I'll never forget that. That's a rare thing.
The show is called Every Brilliant Thing. It's at Windy City Playhouse South. You can get tickets at windycityplayhouse.com. Rebeccaspence.com. My guest has been the actor Rebecca Spence, who is the one star in this one show. It is an experience that you won't forget. Don't waste your time. Be sure you get there by December 15th to see it, because I've been told there won't be an extension beyond that date. That's already extended. So, Rebecca, with my thanks for your time, you were incredible in the role. You're really making a lot of difference. I mean, the play helps, but you're making a difference in people's lives. And
thank
I think
you.
It's great. Congratulations on the incredible reviews as well.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you talking to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.